Date of the Iscast, episode 5.
We're back from May 2006. Yes, hello to all. It's been too long, but we're back and we're going strong, eh, John?
We are. I'm John Coxhead.
I'm Joe McCrave. Your hosts for today.
Episode 5 is here, and I'm sure you're all dying to know what's coming up. So, firstly, we have the freestyle news from the past month, followed by, surprise, surprise, the FPA news from the past month. Then we have, instead of the Discast discussion this month, we have a Discast interview with none other than the 1995 World Freestyle Frisbee Champion himself. It's Gary Overbeck. Following that, we have a new segment, which is Guess the Jammer, or will be explained later. Then we have a how-to segment from none other than Arthur Coddington. And to finish off is the Frisbee Fact and Conclusion.
Okay, good stuff.
We'd just like to apologise to everyone for the lateness of Discast this month. It's a few weeks later than what it would usually be. And that is because myself and Joe are both extremely busy with very important examinations at the moment at school and college. So we haven't really had the chance to do it.
We are, yeah.
But it's still happening. Discast doesn't stop for anything.
Oh, no.
And we hope you enjoy the show.
So, the news for this month. The Paganello results have appeared for the Paganello tournament that took place. The open pairs winners were Tom Leitner and Lorenzo Apriani, while in the co-op, Tom and Clay took home the title with Reto Zimmerman. See shrednow.com, of course, for full results and photos from the Paganello event, and a special congratulations must also be given to Hungarian jammers Balas Major and Gergo Nemet, who are 16 and 14 years old respectively, and yet they still managed to finish 6th in the open pairs and 4th in the co-op finals. Those young jammers from the UK and Israel better watch out. The Poderstorf results have also come in more recently. In the open pairs, this was won by Thomas Gerubin and Firneck Orots. In the turbo shred division, however, Thomas Gerubin again came first, and the second was Balas Major, and third was Gergely Nemet, and the intermediate was won by, I'm sorry, I really can't pronounce your name, but something along the lines of Ali Dastrange. Again, see Shred Now for full results, and again, watch out for those tricky twosome known as Balu and Gary. The upcoming World Masters and Juniors tournament is just around the corner. The entry fee is only $60, and it's taking place from the 4th till the 8th of July. Miss this one at your own peril, folks, because Skippy says, be there or be square. The Jammers 2006. This event is taking place, well, now, as this is being recorded. It's Friday through to Monday, the 26th and 29th of May, with the competitive portion being on this very Saturday, the 27th of May. It's been confirmed, by Danilo, of course, that the Rosetto Vola Volo Beach tournament will happen the weekend after the EFCs, so that's the European Freestyle Championships, in Rome, and that'll take place September the 9th till the 10th. Vola Vola. And also, while we're on the EFCs, Lorenzo Apriani is calling all US players who may not be too aware of the event to consider coming along. You can be a paid judge and receive free accommodations and jam with everybody at the weekend, and they'll even be a show during the finals, and of course you can be there for the great atmosphere of the EFCs. Finally, the Virginia State's 30th annual freestyle tournament took place back in early April, with 158 entrants overall, but 18 of these were freestyle teams. The winners from the open freestyle pairs, it's quite a lineup, were Toddy Broder, Ted Overhouse, Randy Silvey. Well done, guys.
Congratulations. Moving on to the FPA news. Again, memberships. If you're competing at the FPA Worlds or the European Freestyle Championships, then you need a competitor membership, which are currently available for $25.
Sure.
See freestyledisc.org, the FPA site, or go to rightslife.com to buy these. Also a note that the fees will actually go up on June the 30th for competitor memberships from $25 to $45. So save yourself some money and save the FPA a lot of hassle by getting those memberships ordered sooner rather than later. And also, if you're currently on a Jammer membership, then you can upgrade to a competitor one. It costs between $15 and $20. But if you leave the upgrading to actually on the day of the event, then the upgrade will cost $35. So again, save yourself money and get your membership upgraded sooner rather than later.
Definitely. Now, many board positions will be up for re-election for the FPA in the coming fall. Autumn, if you're in Britain.
It is.
So start thinking about who you might want to nominate for these board positions, or even if you want to run for a position yourself. Being on the board member of a non-profit organisation can, of course, look great on a resume or a CV, and also we need for our FPA much more Europeans getting involved and getting on the board. All you need, say the FPA, is an opinion, email, and a love of the sport. There's no other experience required.
So, anyone can do it, really.
Great opportunity.
Why not you? Also...
Oh, John, I think I'm a little inexperienced.
That was more to be the listeners. But, of course, you could do the job perfectly. The FPA are looking for locations for the 2007 Worlds and for future years, and also for the EFCs in 2007. If you're interested in running a major freestyle event, you know, if you think your region or country is ready to fire up some new players and get a big tournament going, then send an email to Tom Leitner, that's beachjammer@yahoo.com. Any entry is welcome, doesn't matter where you are. Go for it.
Now, a big thanks from the FPA to MBNA. That's the commonly known credit card company, of course, if you're in America. Because these are the employer of Larry Imperiale, the FPA's very own. And as he's been doing volunteer work recently for the FPA, the MBNA, they have a kind of company policy of sometimes donating money to non-profit organisations if their employers are doing volunteer work. And none other than, are you ready for this, John, a $1,000 donation was made for the FPA.
Wow.
So also, you know, if you work for a big company, this is not you, John, you know, this is listeners again. You work for quite a small company.
I do. You never know, they might donate a couple of pence.
Gallons of petrol, maybe.
A couple of gallons of petrol, yeah. I work at the local petrol station to fill everybody in.
Fill everybody anyway. Up, get it?
Very funny.
Okay,
very
so if you work for a big company anyway, then maybe, you know, they might look to get them involved in similar sorts of programs where they'll make donations to the FPA as a volunteer-run organisation and help us spread the jam.
Indeed. On a more personal note for myself now, this summer, I'm actually travelling out to a country called Malawi in Africa. It's in sort of southern eastern Africa, quite a small country. And I'm travelling out there with my family to support a charity called FOMO, which stands for Friends of Malanje Orphans. Malanje is a region in Malawi. And the charity has 10 centres, all of them in Malanje, and they look after over 3,000 orphan children, feeding them every day and providing them with different activities, things to do, and education, lots of things which otherwise they would have, you know, they'd be without. And one of the things I'm doing while I'm out there is running freestyle workshops and teaching the children some frisbee skills, and the FPA have very kindly agreed to donate 20 freestyle discs, which I have now received, for me to take out to Malawi and to leave out there at two at each of the centres, so they can hone their skills over the next few years, and who knows, May even end up having some...
Maybe.
Jammers from down in Africa, which would be great for the sport. If you're just out of interest, if you'd like to find out more about the charity, head over to www.fomo, that's FOMO.co.uk. And thanks again to the FPA. The charity is really, really pleased with this donation. We can't thank you enough.
Excellent stuff. They all arrived in a fairly sizable box at your house, didn't they, John?
They did. They did.
Along with some discs for ourselves.
Yep.
No, they were not donated, I must just mention.
Of course.
Yeah, and our competitive membership.
Yes. So, we've got ours. It's, you all need to get yours as well.
Yep. We feel fully licensed to plug the competitor level now.
We do. Now we've got our own.
And our respect goes out to all Platinum members.
Oh, yes. Bow down and worship. anyway. It's time for something we've never done before, an interview live on Discast.
And as we mentioned earlier, it's with legendary jammer Gary Auerbach. And he's going to Discast do our interview for us. Let's hear it now.
So, as I've just said, we are joined now by the 1995 World Freestyle Champion, Gary Auerbach. We've got plenty of questions to ask him, and we're sure you can't wait to hear his answers. Hi, Gary, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
We're good, thanks.
Yeah, we're doing good.
Would you like to start us off, Joe, with the first question
okay.
for Gary?
Yep, let's start definitely from the start. How and when did you begin freestyling, Gary?
Well, I think it must have been when I was about 11 years old, and one of my father's friends, who also was a babysitter for me sometimes, would come over, and he'd always have some new tricks to show me. First it was with yo-yos, and next season he was showing off some of his frisbee skills. I remember him able to tip it and kick it, and if I gave him a good throw, he could, you know, maybe tip and kick and kick and tip, yeah. And I just wanted to catch up to him.
That's cool.
All right, so it's quite an early age then, really.
Yeah, I remember also playing a game like on a soccer field, a football pitch, you know, where we were just throwing it really far and trying to score into the other person's goal. So I enjoyed, you know, throwing it as well as just doing the tricks.
That's great. So what was it that made you really interested in frisbee? Why did you want to, you know, you've said... this guy used to show you a number of different things. Why was it the frisbees that really caught your attraction?
Well, I always thought Randy was the greatest frisbee player in the world, and I was catching up with him and learning how to tip it and putting suntan lotion on my frisbee to make it slippery. And then I just met somebody, Stu Godfrey was his name. All this was up in Toronto, Canada, where I grew up. And Stu asked me if I wanted to jam with him. And I didn't quite know what he meant back then. I think I was 13. And he invited me to come down to the beach the next day because they had just had the Canadian Open Championships and the Coloradical team was in. And the Good Times Frisbee Show, Ken Westerfield and Mary Cathron were there. So I got to see some of the best players in the world, I think, at a pretty young age. And that's what really got me excited about wanting to try to do what they could do.
So, Gary, within your freestyle training, we've also heard you had quite a big career in dancing, really. So how did this kind of interest in development in dance help your freestyle frisbee training?
Well, freestyle and dancing have a lot to do with each other. I had a partner in the first years that I was competing who was always telling me to try to point my toes, and I just figured that if I could learn how to point my toes better and, you know, maybe learn to spin a few more times by studying some ballet, that I'd actually become a better freestyler. What wound up happening is that doing pirouettes is really different than spinning off, you know, trying to find a frisbee and catching it. Yeah. But I did start dancing at 17, took ballet classes, and then I actually had teachers who told me that if I wanted to do this professionally, and that's dancing, that I probably need to stop playing frisbee. And that's what I did. I stopped freestyling from about 1985 to 1994. And Yeah, and my dance career, it took me from Toronto to New York City to Germany, and then to Hartford Ballet, and then to the National Ballet of Venezuela.
Wow, that's pretty serious.
It sounds like you're quite successful in that. So how did you actually get back into freestyle once you had finished your dancing?
Well, what happened was in 1990, I was in Venezuela, most beautiful place in the world, I think, and hola, mis amigos en Venezuela. And I stopped dancing. I just decided that really wasn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I stayed down there and taught English for a few years. But I met a whole bunch of people who were playing Ultimate in Venezuela, including a couple English folks from the UK, Chris Mance and Ceci Frere. And we played Ultimate in Venezuela, and before I knew it, I was back into Frisbee big time, but didn't get back into even doing a little freestyle until, you know, 94, 95, a couple months before the World Championships.
Well, it's amazing you actually managed to win the World Championships after such a short time of being back into freestyle.
Yeah, it was kind of a...
Did you pick it up quite quick then?
It was kind of a surprise. It was funny to show up to a tournament not really knowing even if it was the World Championships, but discovering that it was. And I was playing with a guy, another old-time player from Toronto, Brian McElwain. Brian, if you're out there, you know, drop me an email someday. I haven't seen him for a few years. And Brian and I just put together a routine that that had a real sense of choreography, and it was different. But people didn't know who I was, and that was kind of interesting. I don't know if it was an upset, you know, that we were the top, you know, pairs team, or just a surprise. I think a lot of people have told me since then that we, you know, kicked some life back into freestyle. And we just had a fresh routine because we hadn't been competing every year, you know?
Yeah, it does sound like it came in and it was sort of fresh stuff. So how did it actually feel to become a world champion sort of after this long kind of break in this big dance career, you know, once you got there, and how did it feel?
Well, I got to say, I think it was still remember it as the greatest day of my life, because I've seen some video of me being congratulated by a whole bunch of players, people who have become my friends, people I didn't really know at that time, but I knew were really in, you know, with the sport. And I've never seen myself looking so happy. And I don't have any kids, and, you know, I think that's the type of feeling that it was for me. So yeah. It really was amazing.
Yeah, couldn't really imagine how amazing it would feel to be actually an official world champion or something.
Yeah, well, I think I dreamed of it from when I first started playing, you know. It's kind of like, you know, kicking the winning goal at the World Cup, or hitting the home run, or, you know, making the last shot. Thing.
Yeah, did it feel like you'd almost kind of caught up with these great players that you'd been trying to sort of get to their standard?
Well, I'll be honest with you, not really, because I had been out of the sport for so long. The moves that a lot of the other teams were doing, I accepted that I really didn't know how to do those moves, you know, and I'll still accept that. But what I did bring to the game, I think, was, you know, the routine that Brian and I did. I just had a better sense of choreography and the feeling that we were on stage, you know, for that 4 or 5 minutes, and we had to make the most of that, you know, rather than trying to keep up with all the new moves. We just busted out our old moves, you know, moves that I'd been doing, you know, in 85.
Yeah.
When I stopped playing, I could still do them pretty well. So,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, bringing back some old moves, but people recognize them and the way we put them together. And again, just a little bit of choreography, it really helped it.
Cool. So moving on now, you're also involved in something called Spinning Bees. You've got the website, you're doing a lot of work with that. Can you tell us a little bit about what this is and why it was set up?
Sure. Spinning Bees is really my baby, in that I started as a Spinning Bees Professional Frisbee Clinics. It's now the Spinning Bees Foundation. And what it is that I decided in 95, after I won, that I would really like to share what I could do and what I had a passion for with a new generation. I'm going to say again that I was living in Canada, so my feeling was that I wanted to share this with the next generation of Canadians so that there would be another Canadian freestyle world champion someday. Now I share it with people, you know, all over the world. I've been living in the U.S. For the last 4 years now. And I share it with, you know, Canadians, Americans, Europeans, Venezuelans, you know, you name it.
Yeah.
Yep. So and you mentioned you kind of taken it all over the world. Sorry, was the one?
Yeah, I wanted to say a little more about Spinning Bees.
In
Spinning Bees, what I'm doing is I go to schools and summer camps. I also get to do some birthday parties. where I'm an entertainer or a trainer. And what I'm doing is showing people what they can do and not just what I can do. So it's great to wow people, but it's even cooler to show them something really simple. Like, I mean, really simple. You wouldn't believe it. But then when they're successful with it and they go, hey, I want to do that again, and I'm letting them be comfortable with the equipment, being the Frisbee, and then they're going to have fun with the Frisbee, play more. I don't care if they ever do a nail delay or an airbrush or a guidus. It's not important to me. As long as they have fun with that Frisbee and they remember who taught them.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so, yeah, you mentioned how you've kind of taken it all over the world and things as well. Are there any specific examples of projects with Spinning Bees that you know, could tell us about?
Sure. I've had requests, I guess, mostly online, but also in some of those old airmail letters on the blue paper. from people in Ghana, Africa, Morocco,
oh, wow.
Africa, the Philippines, where they just wanted to know what I could send them, you know, videos or Frisbees. And I've always just gone through my old, you know, box of plastic and found them some Frisbees and shipped them down and sent them a few Spinning Bees T-shirts. And a few people have written back to me, again, through email to say that they've got the package and here's some pictures of us all playing Ultimate Frisbee or here's some pictures of us trying some of the tricks that you showed us. And
yeah.
I've also sent a lot of Frisbees down to Venezuela just with my friends who still go back there a lot who live in Miami. So I send plastic all over the world. Can't do it all the time, you know, when people request it, but it gets kind of expensive doing that. What's also neat is I'm trying to put together some of the artwork that kids have sent me as fan mail. I have beautiful pictures that they've made, and I'm trying to make almost like a coffee table book with Spinning Bees fan artwork.
Oh, that's cool. Where did the name Spinning Bees actually come from?
Well, let's see. I decided that I needed to make it a friendly name, you know, to have a business that was going to be working mostly with children and the people who, expose, programs to children. So Spinning Bees seemed to be the most child-friendly name I could come up with. The idea that when I was young, we'd always ask, you know, did you bring the blue bee or the red bee? Or let's go throw the bee, you know, just bee being short for Frisbee. And the concept also that when they're spinning, I think they're a lot more fun. So spinning bees came, off the end of my tongue, and I've been going with it for 10 years now.
That's great.
Great, yeah, you're obviously committed to spinning bees. And so how much of your time is actually devoted to it at the moment?
How much time do I devote to spinning bees? Well, I gotta say all of it. I gotta say most of it.
It's a full-time thing, basically.
It's been a full-time job. There's a lot of time where I'm not, you know, actually working or performing, but those are times when I'm trying to get new work. I do a lot of marketing to teachers and schools and summer camp directors, so just that my name gets out there and they learn about it and what I do. And it's a full-time job. It's a hard job, but I know that other people could do it if if they ever really wanted to take the time to do it.
Yeah. So what are your future plans for Spinning Bees?
Well, Spinning Bees is going to continue the way it is with me, you know, holding the reins and doing most of the programming, teaching and training. There is definitely possibilities that, you know, I'll be able to train some other folks who might enjoy sharing what they love, the passion of Frisbee, you know, with a whole new generation, and teaching young people again what they can do, being far more important than what the player can do. And sometimes that's hard for players, I think, to, you know, say, hey, I've been training for 10 years to show you this really hard move. And the fact is that when they show that to somebody, the people look at it, they don't understand it, and they go, yeah, so? And they get kind of bored. So, you know, by showing people what they can do, you're better off. So we might try to do some training and get some other players involved. I don't know if there's a video and, you know, or DVD in the works.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to keep up with, you know, people like Dave Lewis in the DVD direction, so... No competition there. Yes, it is, yeah.
So have you ever considered expanding Spinning Bees over into Europe, Gary?
Sure. Do you guys want to be Spinning Bees UK for me?
Yeah, that'd be quite cool, wouldn't it?
Okay, I'll come over and train you guys, and when you're out of school, you can, part-time job. Just imagine traveling around, you know, pulling out your Frisbees and wowing people everywhere you go.
Yeah,
you'll have to learn some of the, games and, tricks that I do. It shouldn't be too hard, though. Expanding into Europe, in some ways, I already have, because the times that I've gone to Paganello in Italy, I've been over there 4 times for Paganello and 1 time Worlds. But when I've been there, I've taken the time from the red carpet, which is the... field that they play on there to bring in the kids who are watching, you know. And so there's a group of Italian and I think some French tourists were there too, who learned tricks from me and are probably still doing some of the easy moves that I taught them. And I think in my mind anyway, that's expanded Spinning Bees into Europe. And I was over in England for the World Ultimate Club Championships in 95, just before winning the FPA Worlds, and playing with Venezuela, the Yanomami team. And there also I had a chance to go to a children's festival in London and teach some kids some tricks and throw ultimate passes to them. But I'd also like to find some European Frisbee players or just, you know, athletic coaches who'd like to meet with me for a week and really train them so that they can, spread the Spinning Bees philosophy and teach what I do to other people in the EU. That would be amazing.
Yeah, well, we'll be up for it in the UK, that's for sure.
Okay, all right, we'll let you know when the dates are.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good. So, kind of moving on again, what's your sort of current stance to playing freestyle at the sort of high level now? Are you planning to sort of attend any freestyle tournaments soon? Back to Paganello, perhaps?
Yeah. No, I'm not planning to attend too many freestyle tournaments. The truth is I play with my peers, you know, maybe... once every 2 to 3 months. I have a great time when I do it. I feel a little rusty when I do it because I'm not practicing the way a lot of, or you know, playing it the way a lot of people are. I went to one tournament this year. That was Virginia State's, and I had a great time seeing people. And I chose not to compete, and that was, you know, a personal choice. And I couldn't even stay till the end of the tournament. And I'd love to go back to Italy for Paganello. Each year I say that, you know, that this is the year that I'm returning to Paganello. Haven't been there. And I can't do the World Championships simply because my business takes priority for me. And the summertime is when I'm the busiest.
Yeah. Did you actually win the co-op at Paganello last year or a few years ago?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, thanks for reminding me. I played with Reto Zimmerman and Paul Kenny, and I forced them to do some of the choreography. So, you know.
Yeah, it paid off.
I made them do some silly things. I don't know if anybody saw it out there, but we were reading a newspaper, and I chose the music and said, I think we could do this. And they played along, and it's a pretty good routine. I don't know how it would do at Worlds, but Paul, Reto, you want to try again?
I'm sure I'll be up for it.
It must have been quite a performance. It beat out Tom Leitner and Clay and Pipo in the second team.
Sometimes you just have an edge or you get lucky, and it certainly, you know, position where you play at tournaments helps, you know, to leave the judges, you know, thinking about you rather than the other team.
Yeah.
Competing is interesting. I really enjoy putting together routines, working on choreography, and sometimes I feel if I don't really have the time to do that, I'd rather not compete.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
As much as I'd love to show, you know, other players, you know, beginners and, you know, masters, you know, the moves that I can still do and, you know, the stuff that I still have, but putting together a choreographed routine and making it interesting to watch, again, as if you're on stage, for me is the greatest challenge there.
Yeah, it certainly is. A general question now. What are your hopes for the future of freestyle in general? How can you see it expanding?
Well, I really hope that young players decide to focus on creating their own moves, you know, stuff that they've invented. It's interesting how now with the internet, you know, you can watch other people playing and try to copy, which is really cool. I just remember back to when I was playing. Again, I'm going into my fourth decade, so I remember when I started playing, the greatest thing was to see what you could invent that nobody else you knew did. And that to me created my own style, but it meant that every player looked really different. And I don't know what's going to happen if every player is trying to look like, you know, some of the great players. You know, it's great to be able to watch them, but do those, you know, new players have new moves? And I'd like to see those new moves, you know, things that they've invented that I can't even imagine doing, you know?
Yeah.
I think freestyle is taking off. It's you know, I think still behind the popularity of Ultimate Frisbee, which is now they have high school tournaments here, and I was just at a middle school fundraising tournament for the Sudan in Philadelphia last weekend. And it's just amazing to see young people learning about Ultimate at a young age. I did a little workshop for them with freestyle, and they're like all excited again, just another way to play with that frisbee.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, definitely.
I think the internet's completely opened up freestyle. Like for example, myself and Joe, we would never have actually be, you know, that was how we discovered freestyle through the internet. So I think that's got to help as well in, you know, expanding it around the world.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And again, I think that it's great for you and all the young players who are out there, you know, who can, you know, learn about something new and really take off with it. And, you know, it's true. You got to find something that you feel good about and exercise it and, you know, own it. And it might be something you're doing for the rest of your life. I mean, I always tell the kids when I go to schools that, you know, yeah, I won the world championships maybe before they were even born, because I see kids as young as 5 and, you know, mostly through high school, so up to 15 or 17. But I tell them I've been playing Frisbee for over 25 years, and I hope to be playing Frisbee another 25 years. And, you know, it's such a great activity, you know, and there's not a lot of things that you can do that long.
It certainly is.
Definitely.
Well, I think that just about wraps us up.
Okay. Well, this has been a pleasure for me, John and Joe. Really has.
Yeah, it's been great to have you on the show.
Yeah, cheers. It's been really interesting. Yeah, it's been good.
It has indeed. So thanks again, Gary.
Okay. Yes,
we'll
cheers,
speak
Gary.
To you soon.
Okay, come have a look at my website, eh?
Yep, here. Everybody, go and check out. Is it spinningbees.com? Spinningbees.com, that's Gary's website. If you'd like to find out more about spinning bees and what they do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. We'll leave it there. Back to the main show. So, once again, Gary, thanks a lot for coming on the show today, though. That was great.
Thanks very
insightful.
Much.
Insightful. I'm sure everyone enjoyed it as much as we did.
Yep.
Okay. Now we're going over to another thing we've never done before.
Ooh, ooh. It's
Yeah, go on, you introduce this one, James.
It's a new segment for this month. It's called Guess the Jammer. Basically, what happens is, it's a segment which we do plan to run it every month. We're gonna give you three facts about a jammer which you will not know. Three facts, and you will have to send us an email. If you think you know who the jammer we're describing is from the three facts, send us an email at ukdiscstyle@yahoo.co.uk. It must be an email. Don't leave a message on the forums or the groups or on Strednow or in our guest book, because those entries will not count. Send it in an email and you'll be entered into a prize draw. Everybody who gets it right each month will be the names will be read out in the next episode of Discast, and you will enter the running prize draw to win an as of yet unconfirmed prize, but trust us, it will be good.
Yep, the Discast mystery prize.
Yep.
Now, anyway, to be in with a chance with either the fantastic opportunity for your name to be read out.
A great honour.
No, but just to be in with a chance of the draw as well, here's your clues for this month's Guess the Jammer.
Ooh. Ooh.
Okay. Ears listening at the ready. Right. This jammer started playing in 1985. That's your first clue.
Ooh. Okay. Limit it down.
Yeah, long time jammer. Now this jammer's early years, presumably after they started playing sometime, were spent on an ultimate team in Chicago. Okay, now your third and final clue for this month is that they won the mixed pairs along with their partner at the 1997 FPA World Championships. Get thinking,
get researching, enter the competition. Anyway, it's time for another one of our more popular segments. It's the how-to segment.
Yep.
Done this time by the one and only Arthur Coddington.
Not content with just being a guest once on this show, you know? No, nope. Arthur has kindly done our how-to segment for us this month, and he'll be sharing his wisdom with us on none other than the scarecrow catch. So let's go over and hear that now.
This is Arthur Coddington. I'm going to talk about the scarecrow. Scarecrow is sort of a straight-armed behind-the-back catch. Ideally, it's caught at shoulder level or higher. Most important thing to remember is the scarecrow is a blind catch. If you see the disc when you're catching it, chances are you're not doing a scarecrow. Catching a scarecrow is kind of like learning a move on Discast. You can't see what's going on, so you have to go by faith. You have to develop a radar. You have to sense where the disc is, if it's close to your hand. You need to be able to move your hand closer to where the disc might be. It sounds kind of supernatural, but with practice, it becomes second nature. The best way to get started is to find a way to set the disc over your shoulder the same way every time. For the scarecrow, if the disc is over your left shoulder, you'll catch with your right hand and vice versa. There are a few ways to get this consistent set. The way I warm up my scarecrow is just to toss the disc up flat and over my shoulder, like a little hovering throw. The way I learned the crow was from a rim set. I used to do a behind-the-back rim pull, then set the disc up flat and rotate into the catch. If you have a friend who's good at downwind rim sets, you can ask your friend to set your catch while you practice. And you can also catch crows off speed flow throws. If you're playing catch, try a crow when the disc is going to fly over your shoulder. This isn't the best way to learn the move, though. You're not going to get any consistency in the throws you receive, and more importantly, it can hurt. The disc is flying at you. It's got velocity, and if it hits your hand wrong, Ouch. When you're setting the disc to practice the throw, it should go a little to your side, even a little behind you. Let's talk about a right-handed crow. You set the disc a little away from you, next to your left shoulder. Then you need to rotate your upper body clockwise so your right arm is moving toward the disc in that blind area behind you. At first, just try to make contact with the disc. Figure out where it is. Don't even worry about catching it. The most important thing is developing that radar. Focus on just trying to touch the disc with your catching hand. Once you feel like you know where the disc might be, try catching a few. Clamp your hand down when you think the disc might hit it. Once you get a feel for the crow, you won't have to clamp down as early. It'll feel like you're grabbing the disc as it hits your hand. The crow is one of those catches that you have to work at. If you want it to be one of your money catches, practice it until you can hit 5 in a row, 10 in a row, even more when you're just playing on your own. The crow is a really mental catch, too. If you're not confident about catching it, you're going to drop the crow. It's that simple. Your brain has a way of making that happen. As you set, as you rotate your upper body, as you clamp down, be confident that you're going to nail this catch. You'll catch a lot more of them. And here's a tip that Dave Lewis gave me. Keep your feet planted. He noticed that when I dropped crows, I was shifting my feet as I set up for the catch. When I kept my feet still, my crow became much more solid. A couple more things. Catch the crow high. If you catch it low, around waist level, guess what? You just caught a behind-the-back catch. The higher your arm is lifted, the more exciting the crow becomes. Catch it high above your waist, away from your body. Having good shoulder flexibility helps this. Dave Schiller's shoulder flexibility is great, and because of it, he has one of the best crows. His catch is perpendicular to his body, sometimes even above his shoulders. It's got amplitude. So once you've got your radar, get amplitude. Then get spins, and once you got that radar, you can even get the crow brush. Good luck learning the crow.
Thanks for that, Arthur.
Now we have a Frisbee Fact of the Month up for this month. So
we
John,
do. We
amaze
do.
Us.
We do. I'm not quite... Wait, give me a second. I'll just find the info for my fact, which is stored here. Aha, here we go.
Okay.
All the rustling around, and I finally got it. Right. This month, for the Frisbee Fact, it's a very, very strange one. I'm going to...
That's nothing new.
Inform you all... It's not. I'm going to inform you all about a parody religion that exists, known as Frisbeetarianism.
I'm sorry.
Basically, the basic gist of Frisbeetarianism is that when you die, your soul goes up on a roof and you can't get it down. And then an event called the Ascension takes place, which is where someone comes along with a ladder and collects all the souls stuck on the roof and brings them back down and they live again. So it's like the reincarnation thing. And obviously the parody is that when you throw a frisbee, you know, frisbees often get stuck on roofs. I don't know. And you have to get a ladder to get them down. And then when you bring it back down to earth, the frisbee is once again alive.
Weird. Strange.
So it is strange, isn't it? Would you believe it? Frisbeetarianism. You heard it here.
No. That is something that, you know, listeners won't have heard before, I'm sure.
Yeah. Anyway.
Discast is top for originality.
It is indeed.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing. Who would have thought it?
I know. Anyway. Well, we hope you've enjoyed episode 5. Again, sorry for the lateness of the show.
Nope. But
it's here, and it's been a superb show once again.
Hopefully
new segments.
You can expect June's show to be more towards the usual time.
Yep.
Because we'll finish our exams. In early June, John and me in sort of mid-June.
Yep.
So we can't wait for then. Wait.
Woo. It will be an awesome time.
Yeah. So we'll see you for a very happy discast. I'm Joe McCrae.
And I'm John Coxhead. Goodbye.
Not content with just being a guest once on this show, you know? No, nope. Arthur has kindly done our how-to segment for us this month. So we'll go over and hear that now.
Joe, yes. When we edit this, we'll probably like insert, you know, just one of us saying what it actually is. What he's doing the how-to on.